Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what has happened to America's leverage over the rest of the world? We'll spend this hour with Harvard Kennedy School professor Graham Allison, who's been watching the realignment of spheres of influence since the end of the Cold War, when the U.S. briefly sat atop a unipolar global order. Now, Allison says, China is exerting regional power and campaigning for hearts and minds, and its military budget has grown from 1/25th of that of the U.S. 25 years ago to 1/3 today, and the gap keeps narrowing. We'll talk about how the United States can manage this new reality after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Arts program.
When Americans want to brag about something or complain about something, we often note our unique prosperity and status. This thing can only happen in the richest, most powerful nation in the world. That thing should never happen in the richest, most powerful nation. We have taken our primacy for granted since the Cold War ended, and other countries have found themselves drawn into our economic or security orbit, whether they liked it or not. We've had a lot of power to tell them what to do. But American hegemony is not what it used to be. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We've entered a new era of great power competition, and China and, to some degree, Russia are pushing to expand the footprints of their values and interests in the world and to be able to demand that less powerful countries do their bidding rather than what the U.S. wants. Graham Allison is here to talk about this. He is Douglas Dillon Professor of Government at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His article in Foreign Affairs magazine is called The New Spheres of Influence, Sharing the Globe with Other Great Powers. Graham, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
First things first, what do you mean when you talk about a sphere of influence in the geopolitical context?
Well, sphere of influence is a concept or term that is about as old as history itself, that is therefore an old chestnut, in effect, in the practice of statecraft and diplomacy. And a sphere of influence is an arena in which one state has a substantially disproportionate amount of power, which allows it to then coerce or persuade other states to defer to it. This normally happens in the first instance along the borders and peripheral seas of a great power, where historically, again, this is from Thucydides till today, great powers have attempted to use great power to exert their influence and their interest and their values to cause other states to defer to them on items that they regard as essentially important to themselves. So we can think about the U.S. and its relations with both its northern and its southern neighbor, or indeed what happens in the Caribbean and Cuba or otherwise, which is normal, or the behavior of the Soviet Union after World War II, fearful of its of invasion again from the West, something that it had seen over and over, in which it exerted a most extreme form of sphere of influence by sending its troops and putting in place puppet governments in basically what were the captive nations of Eastern Europe for the whole period of the Cold War.
So obviously being a nation that exerts a sphere of influence on other nations comes with some advantages. What can the nations in that sphere expect in return?
Well, again, and it differs from case to case. Not every sphere is the same, and it's worth doing the fine detailed differences. But in big picture terms, a state that is weaker, substantially weaker than a neighbor, has got to pay a degree of deference to the more powerful state, and in many instances yield to its demands. So when President Trump declares that 3M is not going to send masks to Canada, even though they had a contract for doing so, Canada can either like it or lump it. And they've, in this case, lumped it. Okay, when President Trump says, you know, we don't like the deal we had with Mexico, let's impose a different deal. Mexicans are weak compared to the strong America. They look at their options and they complain and they try to adjust and adapt, but eventually they have to say yes. So in the Thucydides' Melian dialogue, which is kind of the beginning of realism about this, he's got a wonderful line which says, the strong do what they will, and the weak suffer what they must. Hmm.
So after World War II, U.S. foreign policy focused on curbing Soviet influence. What was the effect on parts of the world that did not fall under Soviet influence?
Basically, a great question. So, and it's worth using the history to help us illuminate the present. So in the Cold War, most people may not even remember, but we get to the end of World War II. Now we discover that the Soviet Union, especially expansive revolutionary communism, poses a greater threat to us than the Nazis, which is what the wise men who crafted the strategy for the Cold War believed, and I think that was roughly right. But in any case, we're organizing ourselves to deal with the fact that we have this extremely serious threat. So essentially, we signed up everybody of any weight on our side of the seesaw, as I think of it as a seesaw of power, against a deadly adversary to us. So contrary to George Washington's instructions and every former and every subsequent president's behavior, we did get involved in entangling alliances. Indeed, we created NATO, in which we committed ourselves to regard an attack upon NATO countries as an attack upon us. We never did that before. We stationed a huge number of troops in Europe and left them there. We never did that before. Similarly, in Asia, we created a long-term alliance and military alliance with Japan, and we still have more than 100,000 troops in Japan, helping now in the aftermath of the Cold War over. Partly they're there by momentum, partly they're now part of the counterbalance to China. So basically, the states in between ended up essentially having to choose one side or another of a bipolar, what became to be called a bipolar world. That is, you were either part of the free world, that was our team, or you were part of the evil empire and its allies, and that was their team.
Ironically, the U.S. largely left resistors within the Soviet sphere to their own devices, I guess not least because nobody wanted to stumble into nuclear conflict, right?
Well, it's a great question again, and the answer, most people simply, you know, kind of either forgot or dismissed or don't like to recognize the fact. But every American president, starting with Eisenhower, had the opportunity to try to come to the rescue of freedom fighters when they rose up in the captive nations of first Hungary and then Czech and then Poland, and decided, as the Soviets say, niet, or Russians. So no. So why was that a judgment of Eisenhower when the Hungarians rose up in 1956, even in, and they, I mean, they, and did so with the great encouragement of the U.S. and the CIA, but they were left to be slaughtered by themselves. Why did Johnson decide in 68, when the Czechs rose up, to say, that's your problem? And so Czech Spring was a short period. Soviet troops came back in and suppressed it. Why did George Bush, interestingly, this was not an ally, but it was somebody he was trying to make an ally, the state of Georgia, in 2008, when the Russians basically went to war with Georgia and separated two of its significant states or provinces, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Why did President Bush send them best wishes? Okay, because, and similarly, why did Obama, when Putin took a bite of Ukraine, and annexed Crimea. Every one of those presidents looked at this issue and said, do I want to send Americans to fight and bleed and die for Hungarians or Czechs or Georgians or Ukrainians? Or are you out of your mind? Because when facing another great power with whom war would be catastrophic, and especially a nuclear power, which a war could escalate to a war that would actually make Dallas and Boston disappear. So if that's the fact, then I've got to accommodate you. That's called life.
So is it fair to say that decision that certain states would be left to the Soviet sphere of influence back then, I mean, did that help ultimately to maintain geopolitical stability? Did it serve peace to recognize that Georgia and Ukraine and other states in similar situations weren't worth the fight from the U.S. perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, just think of the alternative. So we could have come to the rescue of the Hungarians or the Georgians or the Ukrainians, and how would that have worked out? We would have ended up in war with the Soviet Union or Russia. And where would that war end? And the answer is God only knows, but there's no reason to have confidence that it wouldn't escalate to the use of nuclear weapons and ultimately a nuclear war. That's actually been the nightmare and issue that I've studied for my whole professional career. And, you know, you can't really accept the fact that we live in a world in which other states have the ability to literally erase our nation from the map. So, you know, that's hard to get your head around. But once you get your head around it, you come, I think, to the conclusion that Ronald Reagan, for whom I proudly worked way back a long time ago, put it, he had his favorite bumper sticker. And once he got the idea, he said, quote, a nuclear war cannot be won and must therefore never be fought. So if that's true, that has implications about what I can do if I don't like what you're doing.
So briefly, Graham, at the end of the Cold War, the U.S. had this sense of itself as the only relevant sphere of influence in the world. Was that accurate?
No, I think you look back on it and you say, whoa, were we delusional? Now, it's not unusual historically that after a great war, there's a sort of a euphoria and oftentimes a lot of idealistic aspirations and unreasonable expectations. But you cannot go back and read the key documents from 1991, 92, 93 with a straight face anymore. I mean, the most significant intellectual contribution to the period was Frank Fukuyama's book called The End of History. Mm-hmm. And you read what it says. It says, we've now come to the end of history in the sense of the end of ideological conflicts between market-based democracies like the U.S. on the one hand and any other comer. Everybody future is going to join in being a market-based democracy, and market-based democracies don't go to war with each other. And if you want to see the popularization of it, Tom Friedman's best-selling book was called The Earth is Flat. And if you read it, I mean, you cannot read it with a straight face anymore. It propounds what he called the McDonald's theory of peace, which is that two nations that have golden arches cannot go to war with each other because their citizens prefer to stand in line getting hamburgers than fighting each other. You say, what? Who said that? They didn't. They were cheesing. That was a satire. These were the documents that informed. And if you look then at the national security strategy in the Clinton administration, which I also served, you look and you say, who wrote that? Did they believe that? And I think the answer is we were caught up in a set of illusions and delusions. Now, many of them were...
I need to jump in here for just a
second,
Greg. Let me take a quick break. My guest is Graham Allison. We're talking about his article in Foreign Affairs, The New Spheres of Influence, Sharing the Globe with Other Great Powers. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Douglas Dillon, Professor of Government at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Graham Allison. We're talking about a piece he published recently in Foreign Affairs magazine, The New Spheres of Influence, Sharing the Globe with Other Great Powers. Graham, help me understand something. Why did U.S. defense spending increase after the fall of the Soviet Union if it appeared at the time that we had so little to fear?
Well, again, a good question. Actually, initially, it declined, and as a percentage of GDP, declined somewhat substantially. We had, again, this was while I was in the Pentagon, in effect, where I was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first term of the Clinton administration. There was a drawdown of some, of proportions, and then basically a leveling off. So partly... The reaction was a drawdown and a reduction, not as sharply as you might have otherwise imagined. And I think in part that was because of basically momentum, but also in part of because the big idea since World War II in the American defense strategy has been to maintain a sufficient level of strength in our own military that it would not make sense for anyone to even challenge us. So the debate that then emerged in the Bush administration and there Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Undersecretary for Policy, was the sort of lead of this, was that the U.S. strategy should be to prevent the emergence of any peer competitor so we wouldn't be in an era of great power competition by maintaining an advantage that was so decisive that other states would decide it's not worth attempting to challenge us.
So a minute ago, you mentioned U.S. defense spending as a share of U.S. GDP. I want to talk about the U.S. share of global GDP. We controlled half of that in 1950. What is our share of global GDP today?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, I give that to my students at Harvard. And they almost never, and I tell them, tell me about U.S. share of GDP and tell me what was it in 1950 or 1945, the period after the Cold War, after World War II. What was it in the end of the Cold War, 1991 or two, and what is it today? And I say, try to remember three numbers, one half, one quarter, and one seventh.
Wow.
So one half, one quarter, one seventh. And you think about that in terms of market share, in effect, if you think of it from the perspective of a company or another agent. If you used to have half of the share of power and now you have a seventh, your hand has changed substantially.
Do you follow that question up by asking them to estimate China's share of global GDP?
I do. In fact, and there it goes from basically close to zero because in the way that economies were measured in 1950, and China was, devastated by a First World War II and then a long civil war. So it came from essentially nowhere to by 1991, I think if I remember, their GDP was about 20% of the U.S., and this is by purchasing power parity, and that's another debate if you want to have it. But basically, that's the yardstick CIA believes is the best yardstick for measuring or comparing national economies. So it was 20% at the end of the Cold War, 1991, and it's 120% today. Now, some of your listeners are going to say, what? Don't tell me that. Ours is the biggest economy in the world, and you'll continue to read that in most of the press. But I'd say go to the CIA website and see what it says. and it's very clear. China's GDP is about 20% larger than ours today.
What kinds of gains has China made relative to the U.S. in, like, tech innovation and production? It's one thing to make the stuff that we invent. Are they inventing their own stuff now?
Okay. My goodness, you're a wonderful reader and thinker. So
thank you.
I'd say they're precisely the right next question. So if you want to read about my take on it, I had the cover story of the National Interest, which is another magazine, on the AI race, the race between the U.S. and China in artificial intelligence. And this was co-authored with Eric Schmidt, who's been the chief executive of Google. So he was the fellow that took Google from a cause to one of the great companies of the world. And he knows a lot about AI, and I know something about strategy. So we've been collaborating for the past year. This article tries to convey what we conclude. And we point out, just to your point, that for a long time, there's been this cliche that provides comfort for complacency, mm-hmm. that says China can, of course they get very good at copying, and they got a lot of little guys that'll work hard and produce things cheaper, but they can't innovate. They can't invent. And then there's another similar cliche that says, and of course, especially in advanced technology, and especially in advanced information technology, a country that's autocratic and in which freedoms are contained and controlled can't compete with the freest, most open country in the world. That's one of our huge advantages. So they simply cannot compete. And while there's a grain of truth in that, if you look at the facts about the most important, most potentially significant new technology on the horizon, artificial intelligence, as we demonstrate in this article, China is now a full peer competitor. Let me say it again, a full peer competitor. And we offer six, we assess the details in six arenas in which China is in fact ahead of the U.S. in important areas of applying AI. Let me just give an example. So now, especially with the coronavirus shutdown, a number of establishments are eager to have you pay, by your smartphone as opposed to with your credit card, since if you use a credit card, two hands have to touch it, unless somebody's wearing gloves. So in the if you look at Apple Pay now, what is it? It's basically a copycat of what in China has been the case for now 3 years, which is called Alipay. Basically, if you go, I remember being shocked by this. This is like 2 years ago. We go to a Starbucks in Shanghai. And so I don't know how much it costs. And so I pull out some money. And the barista looks at me and he says, what is that? And I said, these are RMB. This is, Chinese money. And he says, I remember that. And I thought it was like somebody had come, and was trying to buy something with script. They don't use money. They don't use credit cards. They use a phone that just flashes a barcode, and that's it. Again, to help us understand the competition, all that information about everything. So basically, if you use your WePay or your Alipay, you can on one site with your, do everything. You do all your banking, you do your investments, you can do gifts, you can do purchases. And then all that information they take and suck up the same way Google and Apple and Amazon do to try to, in our case, designed for you an ad that you can't resist. But in their case, also keep track of since all that data gets integrated by their China security services in what's essentially a surveillance state, all that gets integrated. And you now are getting in many provinces a political credit rating on your reliability, the same way you get a credit rating from an American credit rating agency, in which they say, you know, we've been noticing that Graham has a number of thoughts that seem, you know, when he is either their equivalent of Facebook, or when he's doing their equivalent of tweeting, or maybe even when they see a picture of him, because they also have a video link up in most of those cities and states, in which they see him hanging around with somebody whom they otherwise think is suspicious. So there's no question that in many arenas, and I could take you through the others if you want, China is actually ahead of the U.S. There's arenas in which we're ahead, especially in AI research. On the research issues, I think, fortunately, because we're a free and open society that attracts talent from everywhere when we're smart and recruits talent from everywhere when we're smart, we can actually have the smartest collection of people, not the biggest, because they got four times as many people, but we can have the smartest. And actually now, in the AI community, most of the leaders think there are about 100 geniuses or superstars that they've identified, and almost half of them work for Google. And most of those are not Americans. These are guys like Mustafa Suleiman, who's the guy that's been the leader of DeepMind, which is a British-based company that did that built a machine that beat the chess players and beat the Go player, AlphaGo. This guy is the son of a Syrian refugee, who was living in London, and God only knows has this extraordinary talent, and one thing leads to the other, but fortunately, he's a part of our team.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Graham, how is China using this growing AI talent and economic power to buy influence in new parts of the world?
Every way from Sunday. I would say just like great powers have historically, and to be frank, not unlike the way the U.S. has. So when the U.S. was the biggest economy in the world, then as the biggest buyer and the biggest seller and the biggest investor, all of those provided advantages for us. So why can the U.S. decide when it doesn't like the deal that we had with Iran in the Obama administration to tear up that deal and go back to sanctioning Iran because of our economic power? And why can we coerce the Europeans into going along? Because of our economic power. So we've been in that business as well. When we provide foreign aid, that produces a good impression. So when China is the number one manufacturer of everything, so let me say it again, in 2010, again, not often noticed, but we have a China project here at Harvard that I run, and we have a little list that we call China number one, where it's overtaken the U.S. So in 2010, China became the number one manufacturer in the world. So they're manufacturing now of everything, or almost every product, exceeds that of anybody else. So when the U.S. is trying to buy masks today for coronavirus, whom did we buy them from? China. So Trump did an order for a billion, and has been fighting Macron in France, who's trying to buy a billion from France, from China. And the Chinese factories, which were already huge, but which ramped up in January to meet their own domestic demand, are now absolutely running 24/7 and are selling masks to everybody. Who's delivering medical equipment and masks for free and ventilators to Italy? The European partners have each sent to Italy best wishes. And China sent them, 10 or 20 million masks, 300 doctors, et cetera. So I would say every way from Sunday.
I want to talk a little bit about Russia here because we're mostly talking about China. Russia, of course, would like to have a broader sphere of influence in the world. But even while those two countries are competing for influence, they're not precisely the same. I'm curious about how often China and Russia are sort of aligned and collaborating in trying to have greater influence and how often they find themselves in competition.
Again, a terrific question. And the answer is, it's complicated. And let me apologize for continuing to recommend pieces that I've written, but this is another one that I drilled down on a year ago. And my bottom line is that what has developed in the relationship between between China and Russia is an essential equivalent of an alliance. It's a detente, but it's even whether than that, bigger than that, it's an entente. And this is an insight from Spig Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor and who died 2 years ago. But in his last year, he said, the reason why, or the result of the U.S. efforts or campaigns against both Russia and China together is going to be to create what he called an alliance of the aggrieved.
Hmm.
So basically, when Putin, China's leader, Xi Jinping, who is his best buddy, he calls him, Putin. Who was the first person Xi went to visit when he became president? Putin. Who is it that pops up after Xi at every one of these international meetings? Putin. So basically, they have established a quite tight relationship, and it's getting thicker and thicker, and our efforts to resist both of them are basically pushing them together.
My guest is Graham Allison. He is Douglas Dillon, professor of government at the Harvard Kennedy School, and recently wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs called The New Spheres of Influence, Sharing the Globe with Other Great Powers. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Graham Allison, who is Douglas Dillon Professor of Government at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Recently, he has published a number of essays. The one we're focusing on today was published in Foreign Affairs magazine. It's called The New Spheres of Influence, Sharing the Globe with Other Great Powers. Let's go on the phones now to Clark in Hearst, Texas. Hi, Clark.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking the call. Dr. Allison, can you hear me? I'm getting confused.
Yes, sir.
Yes, go right ahead.
The radio. I get this radio. No, I'm getting your radio station that's getting mixed up with me communicating.
I'm sorry that's happening to you, Clark. The screener has written what I need to know, I think, about your question. Clark wanted to know, Graham, China and India are about to become leading economies. Perhaps, as you've mentioned, they are leading economies. How does that influence America's place in the world? How close is India to China? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of conflicts between those two states.
Good question, Clark. Thank you. So, again, it's complicated, but India is on the current trajectory going to overtake China to become the largest country in the world in terms of population. That's the first point. Secondly, if India were capable of getting its act together, it could be a significant rival to China because India and China have a long border. They have a serious set of territorial disputes. They have a long history that leaves lots of wounds. So if we imagine there were a healthy, strong, rapidly growing India, then this would change the picture substantially. Thirdly, India has almost always been what one wag called a, quote, the country of the future, close quote. It always is talking about its promise, and rarely is it living up to that in terms of its performance. So I probably am a bit, I appreciate that I may be a bit jaundiced about India because I'm unduly influenced by Lee Kuan Yew, who was one of my mentors, the guy that founded and built Singapore, and one of my mentors in trying to learn about China. But he had for many years tried to work with India to hope that it would emerge as a strong player in order to have a counterbalance to China and make a little more space for Singapore. But as he said, at this now, he had been doing this for 40 years. So he said he had pretty much decided India is just going to continue to be India. India has got, to take one dramatic example. So the 40% of all Indians are severely malnourished in their first 6 years of life, so that when they reach 6 years of life, their brains are mentally impaired for the rest of their lives. That's a World Bank number. And you look and you say, my God, how can that be possible, given the extraordinary the success of India in some arenas? And the answer, again, it's complicated, but in a world with a class system, which is like an extreme form of what, you know, we would think of in the American context as racism, people who are in one caste don't really regard people in another caste as, you know, their equal fellow citizens. So it's more complicated than that. But I would say if India emerged from an American perspective, this would be a healthy part of the counterbalance to China.
Do China's geographic neighbors view it the way Latin Americans often view the U.S., which is to say equal parts protector and bully?
Yes, it's a good analogy, and again, Americans will find it uncomfortable, but the Mexicans have this saying. They say, so close to America, so far from God.
So I don't want to get to the end of this hour, Graham, without talking about where we should go from here as the United States. Should the U.S. be actively looking to draw a line around its sphere of influence so that some countries on the periphery are definitively out and we choose that others will remain in?
I would say as a first approximation, yes. Let me, if I can maybe make 3 points here quickly.
Sure.
First, I wrote a book about this big picture is now 3 years ago. It was published on Memorial Day 3 years ago. It's called Destined for War, Can the U.S. and China Escape Through Thucydides' Trap? So this book is about what has happened with the rise of China and what impact this is going to have on the U.S. and our role in the world going forward. And again, to jump to the bottom line, historically, when a rising power like Athens 2,500 years ago in Greece, or Germany 100 years ago in Europe, or China today, when its rise threatens to displace a ruling power like Sparta, which had been the dominant power in Greece for a century when Athens rose, or Great Britain, which had been the dominant power in the world for 100 years. Remember the empire on which the sun never set, and the navy that ruled all the blue waves. When Germany rose to challenge Great Britain, or similarly when China rises now to threaten the U.S., mostly those stories turn out very badly. In the last 500 years, there have been 16 times this happened, 16 cases that I describe in the book, and 12 of these ended in war, real bloody, tragic wars. And most of those wars actually end up happening not because the rising power decided it was a good time to attack the ruling power, and not because the ruling power decided I better attack the rising power before it gets stronger. Instead, the principal cause of war in most of these cases was some third party's action or provocation or even just an accident or an event that triggers a vicious spiral of reactions that ends up engaging the two principal protagonists that drag them to a war they don't neither wanted. And the great case of that is 1914 and the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo that created the spark that ended up producing a catastrophic fire that burned down the whole of Europe. I've got a good chapter on that in the book. So basically, the big picture is to understand we're in an extremely, extremely dangerous Thucydidean rivalry from which there's no exit. This is life. As long as China is rising, attempting to realize China's dream, which, as Xi Jinping stated it long before Donald Trump took the line, is to make China great again. So this is called the Great Rejuvenation of the Great Chinese People. And as long as China is succeeding in making China great again, it will be encroaching on positions and prerogatives Americans have come to believe are naturally our own, because for a century they have been. So the idea for most red-blooded Americans, and that includes me, I'm not only red-blooded, but red-necked. I come from North Carolina. So as my wife says, if you wash the mascara off my chest, it would say USA is number one. So I believe that deep in my bones. So the idea that China could be ahead of us in some arenas, I don't like it at all. So unless the U.S. gets over the idea that we deserve to be in a leadership position in the world, or China somehow diverts or crashes from its current trajectory that it's been on now for more than four decades, this is going to be life going forward. Now, does that mean necessarily we end in a war? No. But if we do statescraft as usual, we should expect history as usual. So fortunately, in four of the 16 cases, there was no war. And I try to explain in the book how if we look at those cases and we think about the special conditions of the U.S.-China relationship today, we should be smart enough to find a way to make this more like the cases that succeeded and not fall into, you know, Thucydides' trap. So the book is not fatalistic or pessimistic. It's about why we should recognize that if you're going into an arena of extreme danger, you need to be extremely cautious. And fortunately, if we need it, I'll try to do a silver lining in this. In the coronavirus crisis, we have another flash that should remind us that at least in some arenas, we cannot achieve our own most selfish, narrow, vital national interests in the survival and well-being of our people without a degree of cooperation with China. And similarly, for Chinese to learn, they cannot make China great again without a degree of cooperation with the U.S., because coronavirus doesn't observe borders, doesn't carry a passport. And if China even were to succeed, as they're close to doing right now, in stopping all new infections inside China, the problem that they'll have is that if somebody comes from outside China, they will reintroduce the virus. So unless you could imagine hermetically sealing the borders of your country, you're in this problem with somebody that is kind of an enforced partner. So I've been trying to work in the period since the 3 years since I sent that book to the publisher to try to find the, quote, ways to escape Thucydides' trap. And I haven't come to something that I think, okay, that's good enough. But the best close idea is a idea that's not, you can take some lessons from the Cold War. In the Cold War, as we were talking about earlier, after we decided that a nuclear war could not be won and must therefore never be fought, we became clearer about the fact that we got to find ways to constrain the competition in order not to get dragged into things like the Cuban Missile Crisis that could have killed us all. So that means even though I still, and Ronald Reagan in his bones, believed the Soviet Union was an evil empire, and I believe he was right. So however much he wanted to bury them, he didn't want to bury them at the cost of destroying the U.S. So we then had to find smart ways to compete, but with a degree of constraints and cooperation that avoid letting some third party or some accident or incident drag us where we don't want to go. And coronavirus is a good case where there's spectacular opportunities for us to compete in that regard. And I can recommend one more. Here, you guys will be tired of my recommending my reading, but I wrote a piece on this 2 weeks ago in the National Interest on what coronavirus should mean to the U.S.-China competition.
Well, can you give us, we've got a minute and a half left. What should it mean? How should we respond to this challenge? I mean, obviously, the first challenge is taking care of public health, but what else can the U.S., how can the U.S. view this as an opportunity, if that's not too crass a way of describing it?
Yeah. Well, I think that the opportunity is to force us to recognize that there's some global challenges, existential challenges to us that we cannot resolve, or that we cannot meet or defeat all by ourselves. That, and among those, I would say three visible ones are coronavirus or, pandemics. That is, viruses that will cross borders, don't carry passports, and which, if one party fails to defeat it, they remain vulnerable to reintroduction from another party. So that's a pretty vivid example. And there, if you look at the cooperative work between American and Chinese scientists in trying to develop both a vaccine and also therapeutics, there's a lot of promise there. And if we pursue this together, we're likely to get us a vaccine sooner. That's described in that article in some detail. Secondly,
Graham, we're going to. I'm so sorry, we're out of time, so we're going to have people read the article and get that from you. I'll also note you and I talked about your book about Thucydides' Trap a few years ago. That's the podcast is available, although I do recommend people read the book itself. Graham Allison is Douglas Dillon Professor of Government at the Harvard Kennedy School. You can read his work in many places, including Foreign Affairs, which published his article, The New Spheres of Influence. Graham, it is always a pleasure. Thank you for making time to speak with us today.
It was my honor to be with you, and I appreciate such a penetrating conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, and the podcast is available wherever you get your podcast. Just do a search for KERA Think or go to our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.